The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Can you hear me okay out there? Great. So I would like to base this talk on an ancient discourse by the Buddha from the Buddha's time, from a particular text called the Middle Length Discourses. And part of what inspired me to do this is that this fall and also coming up, I'm teaching a course on the Middle Length Discourses, and I'm also going to teach an online course on the same text starting in, I think, late January perhaps, through the Sati Center. So I'm spending a lot of time with this text. It's kind of one of the primary kind of texts or scriptures of our kind of early Buddhist tradition. And there's one that I came across recently. I was kind of inspired by it, and so I wanted to share a part of it with you. And it begins with an interesting story. And that is that there is a man who has heard about the Buddha and heard a little bit about his teachings. And he decides to go find the Buddha and become ordained. He becomes a home leaver, becomes a renunciant in the ancient Indian tradition, and then he goes and leaves his home and goes wandering across the countryside to the town where he's been told the Buddha is. And on the way there, he needs to spend the night, and he spends the night in the workshop of some local craftsperson. It just happens to be at the same time the Buddha has left that town where he was staying and is wandering through the countryside, and it gets to be nighttime, and he also needs a place to stay. So he asks that craftsman, would it be possible for me to stay in your workshop tonight? And the craftsman says, well, you'll have to ask the renunciant, who is already there, if he'll make space for you. So the Buddha goes and knocks on the door and says, you know, if there's space for you and it's okay, would it be all right if I came and spent the night here in this workshop as well? And the man doesn't recognize the Buddha. So he said, sure, there's space for both of us. So the Buddha comes in and makes a seat for himself. It says he got a bunch of grass and made a seat for himself to sit on, because that's what they used for cushions, for meditation cushions in the old days. They got grass and bunched it up. So he got this grass and he bunched it up, and the Buddha sat down to meditate into the evening and into the early morning. And this man who was gone off to become ordained by the Buddha, he also did the same thing. So still not realizing it was the Buddha. And one of the reasons I like this story is that usually in the kind of great myths of Buddhism, if the Buddha walked in, you'd know it was the Buddha. But there's these myths, you know, people, the founders of religion tends to become, you know, bigger deals over the centuries, right? And but here in the early text, he wasn't recognized. So I love that. So who knows? Maybe one of you today come in here, and it could be you for all we know. And so so the two of them, without talking or planning it, both sat up meditating to the evening and into early morning. And at some point in the middle of the night, the Buddha thought to himself, this man is quite impressive. He conducts himself well to sit up and meditating, and he's seriously engaged in the spiritual life. Let me find out more about him. He said, well, do you have a teacher, and do you have a teaching you follow? And the man says, well, my teacher is the Buddha, and I follow his teaching. And have you ever encountered the Buddha? And the man says, no. And you wouldn't recognize him if you met him? And the man says, no. And so then the Buddha, not giving himself away, who he is, says, well, what would it be if I gave you some teachings? And the man says, that would be fine, thank you. So the Buddha gives us a set of teachings. At the end of the teachings, finally dawns on this other man, oh, this is the Buddha. And then he asks for, I don't know, forgiveness or something, or apologizes for not recognizing him. And so it's a kind of nice story, a little bit. But what's particularly nice is the teaching he gets. But the teaching he gets is dependent on the fact that this man was sitting up meditating. He's conducted himself well. And I myself am kind of inspired by this little story of two people sitting before they had iPads or television or books. They chose to spend the evening meditating in the dark, I suppose. Maybe it was a moon, it had some light, well into the early morning. When I was in the monastery, that's often what we did. There were times we would go to bed quite late. There were some monasteries I was in, we actually stay up all night. And we would go to bed when at dawn to get a little sleep for the day. And but I spent many, many, many hours and years of my life sitting up meditating into the evening, usually together with other people, sometimes alone. And there was something very dignified about a group of people sitting meditating into the evening. There's something very powerful and strong to be kind of sitting still in a posture that's meant to be kind of dignified, meaning not that you fake your dignity, but it kind of expresses an inner dignity to sit upright and strong and sit this way. And so this soon-to-be monk, had the ability to sit there and meditate and sit upright and strong and into the night. So maybe some of you who don't find this inspiring, that someone would do that. There's a story of the monk who brought what became Zen to China. And there's a lot of interesting stories about him. But at some point, he goes off to meditate in the mountains for 9 years. He sits in his cave in a mountain to meditate. And when I was a relatively new Zen student, I heard this story about this guy going off into the mountains for 9 years to meditate. And I was so inspired by that. I didn't know why. So I went down late at night to the meditation hall, the Zen center, and sat there for a few hours with this kind of very interesting question that kind of kept me alert and very present, very curious about this moment. What was happening? Almost as if I could be really still and very attentive to just, you know, like a cat at a mouse door. Maybe it's a terrible analogy, but just very attentive, very present and still, I would find my answer to this question. And the question was, why did this monk in China sit for 7 years and meditate in a cave? Why would he do that? And so I sat there with that. And it kind of, you know, I wasn't exactly looking for an answer, but I thought, but anyway, so just this idea. So these people sitting up late at night, this is what they do. Why are they doing it? What is it? What's in it for them? What do they have to face to be able to sit upright and still for hours into the night? What kind of doubts assail a person? Is this worthwhile? Why should I do this? I'm not going to be good for work tomorrow morning. Or, you know, Downton Abbey is on, and we have to find out what happens. There's a lot of things, you know, that would keep a person from feeling settled and rooted and present and calm and happy. To be collected and present in this alert, crisp way that sometimes can happen. So here they were sitting. So in order for this kind of the teaching this monk gets, I think it helps to appreciate that maybe this monk had a capacity for a certain kind of inner strength that allowed him to sit upright and present. One of the interesting things, I think one of the important things that comes from having a lot of confidence in oneself when we sit and meditate. And this is one of the purposes of meditation, is to elicit confidence, self-confidence. Meditation is often associated with becoming calm, reducing stress, which is part of its value. It gets a lot of press in America, the stressing effects of meditation and mindfulness. It's very nice. Some people make livings, promoting this. But I think becoming calm for its own sake was not the purpose of meditation in the time of the Buddha. One of the purposes was to develop a strong sense of self-confidence and to sit there with that confidence. And an interesting thing can happen when you sit with a lot of self-confidence. You sit happy, calm, settled, strong, feeling like this moment is complete in itself, like this moment is enough just to be here in this confident way. One of the things that happens is that many of the things that we think are important begin to fall away. Maybe it doesn't matter what happens in the TV. Maybe it doesn't matter. So many of the things that we're so caught up in maybe don't matter so much. They don't matter enough that we want to pick them up when we're sitting there meditating. When we're sitting and meditating, we see the thoughts arise about various issues in our life or various desires we have or various fears we have. And it's just like, this is not interesting. I'm not interested in getting involved in those because there's a strength of confidence here that is better than getting involved in these little petty concerns I might have. But one of the things that becomes less interesting to be involved in is thoughts about self-identity, who you are. So for example, we're sitting there and then, you know, you're wondering about, you're 50 years old and you start thinking about how in high school your hair just wasn't quite right for the prom or something. And, you know, that was really one of the great tragedies of your life. You know, and it defined who you are for the rest of your life, right? But as you sit there in this confidence, this kind of what happened, you know, 30-some years ago at a high school dance or something, just doesn't grab you anymore. I'm trying to come up with an obvious example of something. You're not going to sit there and be caught up in those concerns. But when you get closer to something, you know, something today that we're defined by, maybe we made a mistake at work. And so now our identity is tied to that mistake. Oh, people think bad about me. I'm a bad person. I'm a mistake-prone person. And you can see those thoughts arise in the mind. And the confidence in meditation is such that, you know, it's almost like an umbrella that lets the rain just wash right off. And these thoughts about the mistake at work just wash right off because there's something better going on than defining yourself by what happened earlier the day at work. We can define ourselves by this idea that I'm not enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not beautiful enough, I'm not compassionate enough, I'm not this, I'm not that. And people spend a lot of time with identity issues, defining themselves or concerned that who they are. A lot of human suffering has to do with who we think we are. But to sit with a lot of confidence, a lot of inner strength as you sit there, the need to define yourself begins to fall away. The need to have an identity falls away, at least temporarily. It's like you have something better going on than being caught up in those thoughts about who you will be, what you have been, who you are now, all these kinds of thoughts. And so they just fall away, and things get simpler and simpler. And you become simpler without all these kinds of imaginary ideas, conceivings, thoughts about who we are, who we should be, what we need to accomplish. All these things fall away. And at some point, in meditation, there's so much confidence in being present here, rooted here, that there's no need to define ourselves whatsoever. There's no need to put a label on ourselves, no need to finish the sentence, I am blank. There's no need to be anything. In fact, you could say just enough to say, I am. That's good enough. I'm here. But actually, in Buddhism, we say that the M part is not needed. And you just kind of I. And then we say, but the eye is not needed. And then what are you? Then there's no need for definition. There's no need for anything. Just a kind of simple, strong, confident presence, awareness here. That's very peaceful. So the Buddha wants to give this monk, who seems to have some capacity for practice, give him some very profound teaching. And at the end of the teaching, I'll give you that first, he says he's going to talk about four foundations, that if you establish your life on these four foundations, then you won't be swept away by your imagination. You won't be swept away by the translation in this book is the tides of conceiving, the river of conceiving. Conceiving means the ways we think. So you won't get carried away by your thoughts. And then the Buddha says, if you're not carried away by your thoughts, then you'll be at peace. And here the assumption is that a lot of the ways in which we're not at peace has its source in the way we think, the agitation of our thought, how we get caught up in thought, and how we get swept away into our concerns. And if we don't get swept away, then we can stay here, be at peace. And some of the things that these conceiving, some of these thoughts that he lists that people get swept away and caught up in, it gives in very brief kind of telegraph style, you can fill it in with your own favorite theme to fill in these. But he says, I am is a conceiving. The word conceiving also can mean imagination. I am is an imagining. I am this is an imagining. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. In the future life, or in the future, I will be possessed with a body. In the future, I will be without a body. In the future, I will be conscious. In the future, I won't be conscious. So caught up in ideas of who I am and who I will be, into metaphysical thoughts, even about the future, what's going to happen after you die. All these are imaginations that keep a person at peace. So Buddha says, if you establish your life in four foundations, you will be at peace. So here are the four foundations in this text. It's different than some of you who know about Buddhism when you think about the four foundations. The first is wisdom. The second is truth. The third is relinquishment. And the fourth is peace. So establish your life on those three resolves, so those three purposes, or those three aspirations. He calls them here foundations. So for wisdom, for truth, for relinquishment, and for peace. To establish your life on wisdom, the Buddha explains, is to take your direct experience, whatever's happening in the moment, when you can really get close to this moment, when you've let go of the next day, what happened yesterday, and sit there, maybe with this confidence that this Buddha wants us to have, still and present, peaceful, and to sit there, and whatever happens in the moment, whatever your direct experience is, to be able to see it without any reference to me, myself, and mine. Because when you're sitting peaceful and quiet, any thoughts about me, myself, and mine are an agitation, are extra, are not needed. It's nothing wrong with having thoughts of me, myself, and mine, but you're allowed a vacation. Please. It's rather embarrassing how much many of us, maybe not, one or two of you out there in case you are different, but it's rather amazing how much of our thoughts place ourselves somehow at the center stage in our concerns and preoccupations, me, myself, and mine. And it's wise not to always see the world, see the situation, see our relationship to other people always through the filter of me, myself, and mine. And this is a form of wisdom that the Buddha wants to encourage people to cultivate and develop. To have that the wisdom to not see it through me, myself, and mine does a number of good things for a person. One is it helps relax the agitation that comes from that kind of self-preoccupation. The other is that, even more important, that it allows us to see more directly what's there without having the filter of me, myself, and mine be overlaid on top of the experience. It helps us see the experience we're having much more simply, much purer for what it actually is, rather than what we think. I see. So the speaker out in the outer hall went off. It's on again? Oh, okay, that's nice. It's maybe it was listening to the teaching and decided to get real quiet. Nothing more needed to be said. So then with this ability to not overlay me, myself, and mine on the experience, the Buddha said, that allows a person to see how our experience is constantly arising and passing. Rising and passing. And for the Buddha, the key to become free of suffering is to see that things are constantly in flux. Our direct experience is constantly in flux in a way that's inconceivable if we're in our thoughts. Because the nature of thoughts is to overlay more permanence in the experience than is actually there. Thoughts kind of have a way of kind of like we have an idea of how things are and we hold on to that idea. But if we can drop the ideas and just be in the direct, immediate experience of things, things are moving and changing, arising and passing quite quickly. And if you can see that arising and passing, then in between the arising and passing, there's a possibility of not clinging to anything that's going on. And that's where the freedom is found, is not to cling to this world of our experience. So the wisdom of not seeing things to me, myself, and mine allows us to see things more directly without concepts, without ideas, which allows the mind to let go even more. The letting go of what we're attached to, the clinging of the mind, the way we grip onto things, grip onto our ideas, grip onto our fears and our aspirations, our wishes and our resentments and our hopes and all these things. The idea is to be able to let go of that. The letting go, the Buddha says, is something that's true. So we base our life on the truth. In the second foundation, he defines that truth as the truth of the direct experience of release. So if you hold your hand in a fist really tight, long enough, it'll hurt. And that's somehow true, that's hurting. It's also true that if you let go of that fist, open the hand, you'll feel a relief in the release. It'll feel good to have an open hand. That experience of an open hand is something, is an experience. It's kind of the absence of the fist. The release of the clinging in our mind, the fist in our mind, or the fist in our heart, or the fist in our belly, wherever you hold tight, that release is a thing, kind of like a thing. It's an experience which is very significant. And the Buddha wanted to point to that experience as being true. That's the truth that we should base our life on. If we can have a palpable, visceral experience of what that release is like, that freedom is like of not clinging, that is a guide for how to live a liberated and wise life. So that's the truth. Relinquishment is having known that release, to be able to then cultivate that further and further relinquishment of our attachments in more and more areas of our life. And then the fourth foundation is peace itself. The experience of peace is held up by the Buddha as one of the preeminent experiences a human being can have. Some people will say, well, peace is not good enough for me. You know, there's other things that must be better than peace. You know, like love. You know, I want to be in relationship with someone. I want to love or have love. Love certainly must be more lofty than peace. The argument, counter-argument would be that there cannot be pure love unless there's peace first. That if the mind is agitated, the love is going to be have a lot of static in it. And if there's a lot of static, you know, it's going to be kind of rough going sometimes. The more static, the more rough going the love thing's going to be. And so the experience of peace is a mind which is equanimous, at ease, settled, open, receptive, and has the ability to see much more clearly. So our empathy can operate more clearly, and the world that comes out of our empathy, our appreciation of this world can come out more clearly. Our wisdom, our creativity, so much more can come out of that peace. But it's not a peace that is easy to appreciate, because if we go back to the notion of me, myself, and mine, it's kind of like if the surface of the water is completely placid and peaceful, so clear, the lake surface, you can look over the lake and see your own reflection. And then you think, well, that's an interesting reflection. Look at that person. That person looks great. And so you see that person, then you take your finger and you poke it into the water. And it creates ripples, and now you're all distorted. And that's no good. And so then you get kind of excited. Oh, what happened to me? And I better get back. And so you start stirring your hand around and, you know, trying to get that, you know, reflection back. And, you know, more, you got to do something about that. And because it's important to have that me there. And so you have to make an effort to get the me back, right? And you can't not do anything, right? Because you're important. You have to be, do something to be. But what you have to do is not, you know, if you want that reflection back, you have to stop disturbing the lake. And you stop thinking about me, myself, and mine. If you stop thinking about me, myself, and mine, the mirror-like surface comes back. The clear lake comes back. But as soon as you poke your finger into the lake, you lose it again. But it's me. I'm important. You know, I have to exist. I have to prove myself. I have to apologize. You know, whatever it is. But no, you have to, you know, this radical thing of letting go of thinking about the world or yourself from any category of me, myself, and mine, so the lake of the mind can get completely peaceful. And then the analogy, simile that the Buddha used is that if you stand on that edge of that lake and look in the lake when it's completely clear, then, you know, and you not get, you know, maybe you don't even get sidetracked by your reflection in the lake, you'll see what's in the lake. And you'll see as clearly right down to the bottom of the lake, to the beautiful rocks and fish swimming there. And that same way, you'll look, you know, your mind will get peaceful, and you'll be able to see right down into the bottom of your mind, bottom of your heart, with complete clarity, and see what's really there, what's going on. So, this monk, or there's going to be monk, soon to be monk, hoping to be monk, heard all these teachings, and he said, he thought to himself, indeed, the teacher has come to me. The fully enlightened one has come. Then he rose from his seat, arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, and prostrated himself with his head to the Buddha's feet, saying, Venerable Sir, a transgression overcame me. Confused and blundering, I presume to address you as friend. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive my transgression, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. So you're not supposed to call the Buddha a friend. So anyway, so he apologized. Which is a little bit disappointing to me after hearing this great teaching. You know, it's like, should have just stayed in that space, stayed in that peace. Should have probably closed his eyes and meditated some more, and not, you know, get involved and need to apologize for anything. Just to be here. So four foundations. If you establish your life in these four foundations, then you won't get swept away in your thoughts. And so establish your life in wisdom. And in particular, the wisdom of not seeing things is always through the filter of me, myself, and mine. Establish your life in truth, particularly the truth of letting go. What happens, that feeling, that experience of peace that comes from letting go. Establish your life in relinquishment, which means letting go, to do the letting go. And establish your life in peace, beautiful peace, which can be your gift to the world around you. The world needs a lot more peace. So, maybe some of you will go home now and be curious about why they sat up all night. And you'll go home and you'll sit up into the evening wondering, what is this about? What is it to sit here fully present, confident, strong, without any concern whatsoever for me, myself, and mine? What is that? What is that? That would be great if some of you went home and did that. What is it? What is this moment? What is this here? What? Just here. So what do you think? Do you want to ask some questions or comments? Oh, hand went up quickly. So can we have the mic out in the outer hall?
Thanks. You discussed how we start with I am and we lose the adjective and then we lose am. And then eventually we lose I. And you also talked about how we let go of thought and just be here and experience this very moment.
Yes.
So then, if we did that, how is it possible to evaluate oneself, better oneself? How can you do that?
Yeah. So remember I said, I talked about talking about it as a vacation. There is a time and place. It's all about context. There isn't time and place to evaluate yourself. If you really need to pee, we hope you have that self-evaluation. That's, you don't ask your neighbor to go pee. You know, it's you, and you know who it is, and you know that there is a time and place for understanding oneself and all that. But it's also the time and place to give yourself a radical vacation from that. So you can see yourself and the world through a very different perspective than you can if it's always through a filter of I, me, myself, and mine. And to know there's an alternative. And if you know there's an alternative, then when you do need to evaluate yourself in some way, that you don't take it too seriously. It's not like that's the whole game, is that. And you hold it much more lightly. It needs to be done. You play the game. You go along as is appropriate. But you're not going to depend on it for your happiness.
I agree. Just one last comment on that is that when you follow that line of explanation you just gave, a lot of things starts becoming relative. And indeed, the mind has a need or the identity has a need to attach itself something permanent, something, you know, you want to put yourself...
Yes.
Or your back into a rock or something like that. You know, like you want to hold on to something.
Yes.
And that seems to slip away.
Is that okay?
It feels good. I know that. But it also is very, a little bewildering, I have to say.
Yes, yeah. It takes a while to get used to. But one of the things you should consider, because you said the mind has a need to do these things, if you see it through that perspective, it's harder to work with, because the mind has a need means it's a requirement. Then this is what the mind does, and you have an idea what the mind is, and it becomes a little bit more difficult to investigate what's going on. And to use the word mind too simply, and from a Buddhist point of view, is the same as using the word I too simply, and it obscures what's really going on. So it isn't the mind that has a need, but it might be that that's just a kind of a generalization. But if you look in the mind, what is it that needs to hold on, to get attached? Inside the mind, your fear needs to, your fear drives the attachment. And if you say mind, you can't do anything about it. But if you go underneath that and see, oh, it's fear, maybe then you can do something about it. You can address the fear.
Thanks.
Is there a mic here? Jim, right behind. No, but other people need the...
How do you stay awake all night without coffee or tea or without falling asleep? I would be right to sleep in 1 hour.
Well, it helps if a few things can help. One is that you get enough sleep to begin with. And a lot of people in America, many people in America need sleep more than they need to meditate. So, you know, it's sleep-deprived culture. So sleep helps. The other is develop a strong mind. The mind is like a muscle. And so as your ability to get concentrated, be mindful, and make effort, get stronger, then it becomes stronger than the need for sleep. So but you have to apply yourself.
So you might do that one night. You wouldn't do it continuously.
Well, when I was in Burma, meditating there on retreat, the expectation was that we would sleep for 4 hours a night. And it turned out that we had some leeway when we went to bed. So, and it turned out for me that 4 hours didn't really work. I needed 4.5. to make it really the whole thing work. But what I did was I went to bed early. I was a little bit lazy, right? Sometimes I went to bed as early as 8:30, and then I get up at 12:30, 1, 2.
And you did that how long?
8 months.
8 months?
It was the best, one of the very best times of my life. It was great.
But you weren't paying bills, taking care of kids, for animals, mortgages.
Right, I wasn't.
Right?
That's right, I wasn't.
So, but what's really important for me is the building the bridge.
Yeah.
Between the day-to-day life and the peace.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to do that. I mean, not everyone has that opportunity and that, you know, interest to do that way. But it's possible to go well along those in that direction, and I've known people who have busy lives and kids and all that, who have started to meditate. And once you learn to meditate and do it regularly and get kind of a little bit proficient at it, generally the sleep need goes down. A person needs less sleep. It might not be dramatic; it might be an hour less, but probably you get a bigger return on the time. So it's a kind of a gain, you know, if you meditate well, because meditation can be very, very deeply restful. And sometimes meditation can rest parts of the mind that don't rest when we're sleeping. That I often find myself more rested after my morning meditation than when I woke up from sleep at night, because of the kind of deep relaxation that goes on.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So one more. Pass the mic down now.
So this is a super basic question, but how is there a way to meditate? Like, what is supposed to be going on in your mind? Or not supposed to be?
it's a good question. And there are a variety of different kinds of meditation practices. The practice we teach here is called mindfulness meditation. And in January, I'll teach my next mindfulness. I do a 5-week introductory course where I kind of lay out how we teach it here. But the primary way we do it here is by having a focus of attention in the present moment on the breathing, and stay in the present moment with the breathing, or with whatever else experience in the present moment is most predominant. So it's a way of bringing careful attention to anything that's happening in the present moment. But that attention is attention which is relaxed and focused. And because it's relaxed and focused on the present moment experience, the idea is we don't get lost in thought. And usually it's thought that tires us the most. And so if we don't get involved in too much thinking, then on one hand we don't get so tired, We don't torture ourselves sometimes. And the other thing is that if we don't get involved with so much thought, then it's easier to really start seeing what's happening in the present moment. So the kind of meditation moment we do here is meant to help us to see clearly what's really going on in the moment as it's happening. So I know it's a little bit of it.
Thank you.
And if it's your first time here?
No. Second.
Okay. Because you're welcome to take a copy of my book, which is on the counter as you leave, because that describes what we do here. Okay. So remember, maybe a few of you will stay up tonight. Even just a little bit. And remember that the idea is not just to become calm, but to become confident as you sit there. What does it look like to sit confident and upright? Good night.